Hello everyone, it's Helena here with section 2 of part 1 of my podcast on the life and art of Caravaggio. Caravaggio arrived in Rome in the autumn of 1592. He was 21 years old. Whatever had happened since the signing of the contract of apprenticeship to Petizzano when he was 13, this was a clear signal of his determination to make it as an artist. Because if that was your ultimate dream, Rome was the place to achieve it. Not only was the headquarters of the Roman Catholic Church, but it was also one of the leading centres of the arts in Western Europe at that time. And it was enjoying a period of religious revival. Following the conclusion of the Council of Trent in 1563, the culmination of the Roman Catholic Church's response to the challenge of the Protestant reformers, what we call the Counter or Catholic Reformation, it had found a new sense of purpose, a renewal of confidence and self-belief. And this spirit of renewal manifested itself in the flourishing of the visual arts, with St. Peter's being rebuilt, new churches constructed, old ones renovated. All of these required furnishings with works of art. And then there were the wealthy patrons, many of them higher up clergy, who not only had their own palaces to furnish, but they had influence, connections, and an artist enjoying their protection could use them as a conduit to securing lucrative commissions. So there was plenty of work to be had. Just one slight drawback. Many artists knew that, and they were all there competing for the same work. To make matters worse, the artists, who formed around 2% of the city's entire population, tended to live in the same area. A radius of some 2 square miles, between the Piazza del Popolo and the Piazza di Spagna, a district which was known as, appropriately, the Artist Quarter. So if you were going to succeed in this competitive environment, talent wasn't enough. You needed money or connections, or preferably both. And Caravaggio had neither. He was penniless and he was unknown. And he'd also come to a dangerous city. For all its religious associations, Rome was full of violence, full of crime. There were ruffians, vagabonds, thieves, pimps, prostitutes, ex-soldiers looking for the action. Even when you were at prayer, you had to guard your money, guard your life. It was not the place for a sensitive young soul to be, which is just as well that Caravaggio wasn't one of those. Had he been, he might have found it difficult to cope with the uncertainty and financial insecurity that marked the early years of his stay. It's estimated that in his first year, he moved accommodation up to 10 times. One of his early landlords was a minor cleric by the name of Pandolfo Pucci, whom Caravaggio nicknamed Mr. Salad, because he was apparently served salad for breakfast, lunch and dinner. Not an appropriate diet for an aspiring young artist. We're told we need food to feed the brain. Well, Caravaggio was hardly likely to produce a masterpiece on a diet of lettuce leaf with the odd tomato thrown in. And his pattern of employment was equally restless. He flitted from workshop to workshop, producing hackwork with clockwork-like regularity. 3 heads a day for a groat apiece, according to one of the biographers. We know of 2 workshops where he was employed, which played a formative part in shaping his early career. One was the workshop of Antividuto Grammatica, where he specialised in portrait busts, heads and shoulders, and the other was that of Giuseppe Cesari, otherwise known as the Cavaliere d'Arpino, where he specialised in fruits and flowers, in other words, still life. Now, Cesari was one of the most prominent artists in Rome in the 1590s, so one might have assumed that Caravaggio would have been delighted to be employed in his workshop. But the evidence suggests that the relationship between Caravaggio and his employers was tense. Caravaggio was super sensitive about his background, and he knew that in Rome, people from Lombardy were regarded as country bumpkins, crude and unsophisticated, and he believed he was being deliberately discriminated against because of his background by being given the least popular work to do. Because in academic circles, still life was regarded as the lowest genre in the arts, after history painting, portraiture, animal and landscape painting. And the resentment at the way he was treated may have precipitated his final decision to break away from the workshop environment and set himself up as an independent artist. And this decision in itself suggests he had a strong confidence and faith in his abilities to succeed as an artist. Because there's no doubt about it, it was a risky decision to take. Without the protection of a patron, nor the security provided by the regular employment of the workshop environment, he had no option but to sell his work on the open market, alongside many other artists doing exactly the same thing. It wasn't enough to demonstrate technical expertise. His work had to show his inventive and creative flair. It had to be eye-catching, stand out from the crowd. And also, because he was hoping to secure the custom of the wealthier clergy, it helped if the work had religious themes as well, if only to camouflage the more risky or controversial aspects of the painting. In other words, art that was produced for the open market had to tick a lot of boxes. And A Boy Bitten by a Lizard does just that. Even from a distance, it's eye-catching. It's not particularly large, about 66 by 49.5 centimetres, but it is mesmerising. It's a half-length portrait of a youth with a mop of thick, curly, chestnut-brown hair, eyes and eyebrows to match, chubby face, round nose, flushed cheeks, and the thickest, fullest of lips, parted. He's somewhat effeminate in appearance, with a rose tucked behind his right ear, and he's wearing a garment that is a cross between a toga and a twisted bedsheet. And I think the ambiguity is deliberate on Caravaggio's part. He appears to be in a room in front of a table on which there is foliage, fruit, including cherries, figs and grapes, and a vase three quarters full with water, with a pink rose and flowering sprigs of jasmine. The boy seems to be recoiling from something. His right shoulder is shrugged up against his jawbone, and the hand of that arm is tense. His left hand is raised in a rather feeble and strange gesture, as though he's trying to ward off something dangerous or unpleasant. But it's the expression that catches our attention. It's a mixture of surprise, shock, pain, and disgust. We're curious to know what has caused this reaction in the boy. Well, you can get there quickly by reading the title, but even without that guide, it doesn't take you long to find out. Because the fleshy part of the middle finger of the right hand of the boy has been bitten by a small green lizard, well camouflaged among the foliage. And even as the youth withdraws his hand, as he becomes conscious first of the pain and then the presence of the lizard, the little creature clings on tenaciously to the boy's finger. It isn't difficult to work out the sequence of events leading up to this moment of drama. The youth has seen the fruit on the table. He's been tempted by its appearance and smell and has reached out his hand to select a piece. He may well have been smiling in anticipation of the unalloyed pleasure he will enjoy tasting the sweet and juicy fruit, instead of which he experiences the shock and pain of the lizard's bite. And it is that contrast between the anticipation of pleasure and the experience of pain that accounts for the extreme reaction on the part of the boy. Because I'm sure you'd agree that the reaction is somewhat over the top, out of proportion to the actual suffering and danger that the boy faces. It is, after all, just a tiny lizard. It's not as though he's been attacked by a snake or crocodile. And I think this mismatch is deliberate, to lighten the mood of the painting somewhat. But it is very dramatic nonetheless. And this is partly created by the lightning effects. Caravaggio has illuminated the interior with a strong single raking light from the top left-hand side. And where the light catches, the side of the boy's face, his shoulder, his tensed hand, these are thrown into sharp relief. It's as though the boy is coming into our world, breaking that barrier between the picture plane and the viewer's space. It makes it so believable, to the point that were the boy to start shaking his wrist to get rid of the lizard, so it's thrown in theory into our space, our instinct would be to hold out our hands to try and catch it. It has that degree of realism about it. And it's the chiaroscuro, that dramatic contrast between light and shade, for which Caravaggio was well renowned and was indeed the supreme master. It's that which gives the painting its intense realism, drama, and emotional and psychological impact. And contemporaries would have found the painting very novel too, not just because of the lighting effects, but because of the subject. They were used to portraits, they were used to still life, but they weren't used to the combination of the two in this way. And Caravaggio has drawn upon his experience in the workshop of Antividuto Grammatica, where he specialised in portrait busts, and that of the Cavaliere d'Arpino, where his specialism was still life. And he's combined the two to produce a new type of genre, a narrative drama with moral content, what you might call an everyday action picture with layers of meaning behind the headline story. And there is a simple moral attached to this painting. The boy has been tempted by the fruit, he's given into temptation, and he's been punished for his greed. And frankly, I don't feel very sorry for the boy. It's not a very sympathetic portrayal of the youth. He appears petulant, spoilt, used to getting his own way, not accustomed to the hard things of life. He's had his comeuppance, his just deserts. If anything, I feel sorry for the lizard. He meant no harm towards the lad. He acted in pure self-defence. But I don't rate his chances of survival very highly. I don't trust the boy. I think he'll be angry, seek revenge, and kill the lizard. And it's interesting that my emotions are the reverse of what I would expect them to be. It's as though they're being deliberately manipulated by Caravaggio. Well, we've understood the narrative of the painting and its moral conclusions. We've acknowledged the dramatic and emotional impact it has had upon us. So all is done. Well, not quite. It's not enough for us to admire the painting. Caravaggio needs us to buy it. So he has to keep our attention long enough in order to secure the sale. He's attracted our attention in the first place by the unusual expression of the boy. We've been intrigued to find out what's caused this and found the answer in the lizard, and then worked out that the boy was tempted in the first place by the fruit on the table. And that is where we're caught, by Caravaggio's superb rendering of the fruit. I mean, it's good enough to eat. Then we move on to the flowers. We can almost smell the perfume of the roses and the sprigs of jasmine. Then we come to the vase. And this is the pièce de résistance. Caravaggio not only gives us the texture and material of the vase, he's also shown the way that light reacts when it encounters another surface. So we see how it makes the water look like milk at the base of the vase, and he gives us the viscosity of drops of condensation on the outside and the reflection of a window, which is possibly the artist's studio, which bends to accommodate the convex shape of the vase. Caravaggio clearly knows all about the refraction and reflection of light, and he demonstrates it in action in this painting. This is essentially Caravaggio showing off, demonstrating his virtuosity in the genre of still life. This is where his background was an advantage to him, because coming from the north, he was well acquainted with the work of the northern Renaissance artists, Bruegel, Van Eyck, Memling, Dürer, who were known for their skills in depicting the world with breathtaking realism. And Caravaggio shows here that he's their equal. And he's also the champion of the still life genre. He once claimed that it took just as much skill to paint a flower as a figure. And it's often forgotten when we concentrate on the innovations Caravaggio made in the field of religious painting and his everyday low-life genre paintings, that he was also a pioneer in the genre of still life. He produced one of the earliest pure still life paintings in his Basket of Fruit of around 1596, which is in the Pinacoteca Ambrosiana in Milan. And this is still life with substance, art imbued with deeper meaning. Because one of the beauties of the still life genre was it enabled the viewer not just to study everyday objects, but to reflect on their transient nature and the brevity of human life, which was much harder to record in paintings of humans compared with paintings of objects that had a much shorter lifespan, like fruit. And following on from this reference to the brevity of life came a reflection on the foolishness of humans, on focusing all their energies into building up earthly treasures, which is the Bible worn, rot and decay, instead of concentrating on heavenly treasures, which are indestructible and eternal, and built up using qualities such as kindness, generosity, love, compassion, and goodwill. And this reflection on the folly of humans became known as the vanitas theme in the still life genre. And the vanitas theme is evident in Caravaggio's Basket of Fruit painting. Because the wonderful selection of apples, peaches, pears, grapes, figs, quince are all ripened to perfection, but they are also on the turn. So a black wormhole mars the shiny red skin of the apple, and two of the grapes have shriven to raisins. Some of the leaves have the black spots of age, or have thinned to the consistency of paper, or curled up. A very literal expression of, in the midst of life are we in death. And the basket itself is placed on the narrowest of ledges. It overhangs the edge. So at any moment, it could topple off. And this reminds us of the precarious nature of all our lives. And Caravaggio was all too well aware of that from his own experience. And the vanitas theme is also evident in his boy bitten by a lizard. Because all of these beautiful objects have one thing in common. They are pleasures which are brief. So the delicious fruit will either rot or be eaten. The beautiful flowers will wilt and die. The water will evaporate or be spilled. The vase, if care is not taken, could fall to the ground and shatter into thousands of pieces. And the reflection will disappear when the sun goes behind a cloud. The boy is symbolic too, because he is just that, a youth who will face adulthood, old age and death. And the lizard too is a symbol of the brevity of life, because by Caravaggio's time, the lizard was a substitute for the serpent in art. The serpent who tempted Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden with the forbidden fruit, which led to their expulsion from the garden by God as a punishment for their disobedience. So the serpent is often seen in art as a symbol of evil and temptation. But it is also a symbol of the passing of time. Because what is of central importance in the Adam and Eve story is that when the couple were in the Garden of Eden in paradise, they lived forever. When they were expelled from the garden, they became mortals with a limited lifespan. So the serpent or lizard in art can also represent the passing of time. And that is the meaning implied in this painting. That's why lizards are often found in still life paintings. And they also feature in a splendid painting by Lorenzo Lotto, Portrait of a Young Man in His Study, which is in the Galleria dell'Accademia in Venice. Dates to 1527, and it shows a wealthy young man standing at a table, leafing through a large account book with a mournful expression. The lute and hunting horn in the background imply that he has set aside the pleasures of his youthful days and assumed in their place his adult responsibilities and commitments. But the brown lizard on the table near to the book implies that just as his youth seems a distant memory, his adult life will pass by all too quickly. So by Caravaggio's time, the symbol of the lizard as representing the passing of time was well established. But Caravaggio's painting isn't just a warning about the passing of time. It is also a warning about how we use our time. And that's where the appearance of the youth is significant. Because with the rose tucked behind the ear and the Roman toga, he's presented in the guise of Bacchus, the Roman god of wine and merriment. Now, Caravaggio did a number of portraits of Bacchus, some thought to be self-portraits. It's hard to tell in this case, but I do think that even if Caravaggio used a model for the main figure, the extreme expression of the youth is his own, which he copied from a reflection of his face in a handheld mirror. Now, Bacchus was a god of excess. He did too much of everything. He drank too much, he partied too hard, and he slept around with too many people. And in this painting, Caravaggio is particularly warning against the dangers of promiscuity. We can tell this is a key theme by the fact that the boy's middle finger is being bitten. Even today, to point the middle finger is a rude gesture with sexual connotations. And it goes back to Roman times, when it was known as the digitas impudicus. Now, to Caravaggio's contemporaries, a bitten finger signified that someone was afflicted with a venereal disease. In a city full of prostitutes, venereal disease was a common feature of life. The argument that Caravaggio is warning in his painting against the dangers of promiscuity is substantiated by the suggestion that Caravaggio may have taken inspiration from a drawing by a female artist, Sofonisba Anguissola, of a boy bitten by a crayfish, dating to 1554, which is in the Museo di Capodimonte in Naples. It shows a young boy who is crying because his hand has been bitten by a crayfish, one of many piled up in a basket in front of him, and a girl next to him is laughing rather spitefully. And this may be a playful allusion on the part of the artist to the hazards which will face the boy as an adult in his sexual activities, because the crayfish has similarities to a crab, which in turn alludes to venereal disease. And if you compare this drawing with the painting by Caravaggio, the similarities in the gestures and expressions of the two boys are striking. Now, Caravaggio may have been using Bacchus as a means of conveying his message, but that message is directed to a contemporary audience. And this is where the ambiguity regarding the clothing comes into play, because that Roman toga could just as equally be seen as a twisted bedsheet, suggesting a young lover who has just risen from a passionate night of lovemaking. And the presence of the jasmine flower is significant too, in art a symbol of lust and passion, as opposed to the purity of innocent, true love. The implication is that the youth has been tempted not just by fruit, but by sexual desire. He's given in to temptation and is suffering the consequences. Now, you might rightly argue that Caravaggio was hardly in a position to take the moral high ground as far as sexual conduct was concerned. But we have to remember that he is targeting a potential wealthy clerical customer. And this painting in particular, with its vanitas theme and the morality of it lifted straight from the Bible, and the warnings against promiscuity, gave a priest the perfect alibi to buy a painting of what was essentially a pretty young boy. And he could also argue that the painting had none of these sexual themes. Rather, it was primarily a study of extreme expression and also a study of the five senses. And this is where Caravaggio has executed his masterstroke. He's made possible in art that which is impossible, the representation of the senses. Touch, taste, sight, sound, smell. For the youth has been tempted by the sight and smell of the fruit. He's reached out his hand to touch and then taste its sweetness, and he's experienced instead the sharp shock of the lizard's bite. He withdraws his hand and he screams in pain. And though, of course, it is a silent scream, if we, the viewer, can fully engage with this work, then we, in our imagination, can supply the sound, hear the scream. It's a perfect collaboration between the artist, the art, and the viewer that makes this work complete. Seems so obvious when we think about it. But Caravaggio was one of those artists who knew the importance of communication between the viewer and the artist, and he made it so central to all his work. What is most astonishing about Boy Bitten by a Lizard is the painting wasn't an immediate success. Caravaggio ended up selling it for a pittance, and he was left desperate for money. Now, it's often at times when we hit rock bottom that we realise we can't go it alone. We need good friends. And Caravaggio had such a friend in Constantino, Sparta. He was an art dealer who was a great admirer of Caravaggio's work and sold his paintings on commission, and the two regularly met for drinks. And like Caravaggio, Sparta was short of money. He had a wife and a large family to feed. And Andrew Graham Dixon, in his biography of Caravaggio, suggests that the two may have hatched a plot together to try and secure the business of a very wealthy clergyman who lived just round the corner from Sparta's shop and was one of his clients. He was Cardinal Francesco Maria del Monte. Well, with a name like that, you've got to be important. And he certainly was. He was a great lover of new music and supported the composition of the first opera in Italy. He also loved science, and he was the principal patron of Galileo. Without Del Monte's support and protection, Galileo may never have been able to produce the groundbreaking work that he did. And he also loved new art, and Caravaggio has already shown us that he could deliver as far as that was concerned. So maybe Sparta suggested to Caravaggio that he should produce a couple of paintings that might have a specific appeal to the cardinal. Then they could be displayed prominently in Sparta's shop when the cardinal was due to visit, and Sparta would then use all his marketing skills to secure the sale. Well, Caravaggio came up with the goods. He produced two paintings in a new genre of art, what you might call low-life genre, which was hugely innovative. And they both have a similar theme, a young aristocrat who is robbed of his money through trickery. Now, the first of these paintings is The Gypsy Fortune Teller, which is in the Capitoline Museum in Rome. On the left-hand side of the painting is a young gypsy woman who has enchanted a wealthy young gentleman with her beauty and is in the process of telling his fortune by reading his palm. Judging by his besotted expression, he is far more interested in her face than his fortune, which is fine by her, because captivated and distracted by her great beauty and her intense stare, he fails to notice that while she's reading his palm, she is also relieving him of one of his expensive rings. So she's a cunning thief. And the gypsy may have been based on a character, the Zingara, from a comedy play by the same name, which had been performed a few years earlier in Rome by one of the leading acting groups, the Commedia dell'Arte. And Del Monte, being a lover of the theatre, had seen the play and therefore would have been reminded through the painting of the memorable performance of the leading actress, Vittoria Pacini, in this role as cunning thief and temptress. And the other painting he produced was The Card Sharps, which is in the Kimball Art Gallery in Fort Worth, Texas. The painting shows a young aristocrat, sumptuously dressed in deep red velvet over a lace-trimmed shirt, seated at a table on the left-hand side, playing a game of cards. The backgammon set on the table in front of him suggests that he's already lost some money and is hoping to recoup his losses. His calm, composed expression as he studies his cards suggests he's confident of success. But we know otherwise, because his young, feather-capped opponent, standing on the opposite side of the table to the right-hand side, is a cheat known as a card sharp. His back is towards us, and this enables us to see the spare cards that are tucked under his belt behind his back. The older, bearded gentleman, standing slightly behind the aristocrat, is his accomplice. He's peeked over the shoulder of the aristocrat and is signalling to his partner in crime the cards he'll need to produce in order to win the game. Now, the two card sharps would have probably entered the room and greeted the aristocrat separately so as not to reveal their professional relationship. But Caravaggio gives us a clue as to their connection by their costume. Because though the costumes are different, they are linked by a common design, the black and yellow stripes, which suggest wasps being attracted by the sweet scent of nectar. And in this case, the card sharps have been attracted by the expensive clothing of the aristocrat, singling him out as a suitable target for their deception. Now, Caravaggio was clearly well acquainted with the tricks of their trade. For example, the holes in the gloves of the bearded card sharp may suggest to us poverty, but in fact, they indicate his trickery, because the threads of the gloves have been deliberately unpicked, so with his fingertips, he can feel the back of specially marked cards. The superb chiaroscuro effects, the picture cropping, the fine details of expressions of the protagonists really bring this painting to life, make us fully engage with the action. But Caravaggio does not intend this to be a photographic-like snapshot of low-life Rome. In real life, the card sharps were smooth and sophisticated operators, whereas the gestures and expressions of the bearded card sharp are exaggerated to the point of caricature and would have given the game away to the most naive victim of their crime. No, Caravaggio has more the theatre in mind, with these characters being actors on a stage, performing in a comedy or farce. And we, the viewer, are like the theatre audience being brought into the confidence of the actors. We are in the privileged position of seeing what is going on, to the point that we might be prompted to shout out to the aristocrat, "Watch out, he's looking at your cards!" A typical, "he's behind you," pantomime cry. But I'm not sure we'll do that. I don't think our sympathies are intended to lie with the aristocrat. His composure has a hint of arrogance about it, a reflection on his social status. We get the impression that even as is likely he loses his game, he'll leave feeling disappointed but not devastated by the result. It won't make much of a difference to his financial position, whereas the intense concentration of the card sharp's expressions and their feral, predatory-like postures betray their state of desperation. The outcome of the game really matters to them. It's a difference between them having food that evening or going without. And while the overall mood of the painting is light-hearted, there is nonetheless, I believe, an undercurrent of social commentary. In a city ravaged frequently by disease, war and famine, high unemployment was a common feature of life. And if you were without work, you had to rely on charity or begging or crime, or a combination of the three. And it's interesting that there is a similarity in the faces of the young aristocrat and card sharp, possibly the same person modelled for them both. But also there may be an implication that were the aristocrat to be in the shoes of the card sharp, he would behave no differently. Or to put it another way, the card sharps are criminals, not because of their character, but because of their circumstances. And Caravaggio would have empathised with their position. He knew what it was like to be without money, and the painting was a product of his own desperate situation. And the theme would also have resonated with Del Monte, who had a great sympathy for the plight of the poor. But also, as a man of the cloth, he would have appreciated a much more straightforward moral interpretation of the painting, the contrast between good and evil behaviour, and the warnings against the consequences of gambling. Now, when we're busy focusing on the novelty of the genre and the interesting story being told about the card sharps, it's all too easy to overlook the superb quality of this painting. I mean, Del Monte wouldn't have bought it had it not been. The principal patron of Galileo, the sponsor of the writers of the first Italian opera, he had a very critical pair of eyes. But Caravaggio doesn't disappoint. I mean, the virtuosity of his chiaroscuro is almost a given, and yet we have to remember this is still very early on in Caravaggio's career. The way in which he beautifully details the facial features of the protagonists, contrasting the swarthy complexion of the older bearded card sharp with the smooth complexion of his young accomplice and the aristocrat. The way he beautifully describes the different textures and materials of the costume, he renders so perfectly the different gradations of colour of the red velvet top of the aristocrat and the soft, luxurious thickness of the material. The intricate lace trimming at his wrists and neck. We're given the distinct patterns on the silk waistcoats of the card sharps and of the tablecloth, and he even shows us extra folds of material at the wrist of the grey glove of the card sharp as he twists his hand, signalling to his young accomplice. But for me, the pièce de résistance is the feather in the young card sharp's cap. It's so light, it's so feathery, and we can almost feel it tickling our skin. And see where static electricity has caused individual strands to stick to the card sharp's cap. I could go on and on, but I think you get the point. It's simply divine. And the cardinal must have liked it, because he bought both paintings. So Sparta got his commissions from the sale. Caravaggio got the balance of the proceeds of the money. But he got much more than that. Because not only did the cardinal buy the painting, he invited Caravaggio to enter his household. Caravaggio accepted the invitation, and it was a turning point in his life. Because by entering the household of Del Monte, he enjoyed the cardinal's protection, support, and patronage. And as a result of his position, he undertook commissions for the cardinal, work for some of the cardinal's most important clients, including the wealthy and powerful Medici family, and he also secured, through the cardinal's influence, the commission that would change his life and career forever. And that will be the subject of part two of my podcast. Until then, I urge you to check out the London Walks website. There you can see the whole range of fascinating podcasts to listen to, and also the full selection of virtual tours, which are absolutely superb. And they range from virtual tours of museums and art galleries to themed tours to tours of London sites, sites in the UK and abroad. And you can enjoy them all from the comfort of your armchair. Also, you can get the up-to-date information on London Walk's personal roadmap to their exit from lockdown. So you'll have the latest news on when they'll be able to launch their regular tours, for which they have a worldwide reputation for being simply the best. So if you can have the best, why settle for less? And in the meantime, I'll be working on producing further podcasts on individual works of art, as well as part two on the life and art of Caravaggio. And I very much hope to enjoy your company when those podcasts are completed and released. So have a wonderful spring and do stay safe. Goodbye.